Let's go through every single package installed with a Linux install image. I'm going through the software included with Slackware, but these are all open source applications and libraries, so whether you're running Slackware like me, or Fedora, Debian, BSD, or even Mac or Windows, you can probably download, install, and try these on your computer. So chances are, you'll be able to learn something from this podcast. Let's get started. This is the first episode within the X directory. This is the package set that contains applications and I think probably some libraries, things that rely on X to run, or at least that's what I thought. Actually, the first one doesn't appear to require X, but I'm assuming that it's being used in an X in something that does require X. It is OpenCC, and the reason this is at the top of the list is because it's a capital O, and the first, and so the listing in the Apache web server puts it at the top, and then all the lowercase after it. So OpenCC is the top of the list, even though it doesn't start with A, even though it doesn't appear to require X to run. But what it does is it converts characters between traditional and simplified Chinese. I don't know anything about Chinese, really, so this was really difficult for me to try to sort of fathom, like to sort of prove to myself that it worked. I went to some sites with some Chinese characters on it, including one that the goal was to teach Chinese. So I looked for traditional characters and I pasted it into a text file and did OpenCC-I for in and put, you know, simple or traditional.txt, dash O for out, and then simple.txt, and it rendered the same character. It just copied the character from traditional over to simplified. So I don't know if that wasn't a traditional character that I tried, and I tried a couple. So I don't know if I was just trying the wrong ones or whether I had essentially OpenCC misconfigured, which is to say not configured at all. I just thought that the default would go from, you know, auto-detecting the character to what it would have, whatever it would be in either simplified or traditional, because it says it can convert between the two. But I don't know, maybe you need to configure it or something. The command runs, like it runs successfully, so that's cool. I do note that there are a lot of JSON files which are configuration files, so there's that, and then there's a bunch of C++ header files as well in user include, so I think it's probably quite useful for other applications. It also has OpenCC underscore dict and OpenCC underscore phrase underscore extract because it can do both characters and phrases, which again, I wouldn't know what that really means. I didn't know that something would see Chinese differently between a character and a phrase. So I really, obviously way out of my depth here, and it does run, it doesn't crash, and I believe that it's probably here because it's used in other applications. I think that's OpenCC dash dash help, that provides the commands and the required arguments. It tells you what to put into your command. That's how to learn a little bit more about it. Honestly, there's not a whole lot that I could find I mean, there's no man page. I didn't really see a whole lot of documentation on the GitHub. I'm imagining it's probably self-explanatory for someone who actually knows a thing or two about Chinese. Okay, next one up is Anthy, which is another thing I know nothing about. It's a library for Japanese text input, believe it or not. It converts hiragana text to kanakanji, mixed text. Kanji I've heard of, but I don't know anything about the other two. There are a couple of executables in this package, but they don't look like they would be useful directly without knowledge of again, the Japanese writing system, but also just on their own, like anthy-agent. That doesn't sound like something you would run for some kind of visible result. All right, let's switch over to something that I actually vaguely understand. The next one in the list is called AppRes or AppRes. It stands for Application Resource, and it is a command that shows you the resources that an application will use or you can specify the application, the a specific instance of the application using a name. Its man page very kindly provides a sample command right after the introductory paragraph. No messing around. It's great. I love it. So app res space xterm, but xterm is capitalized notably. XT are capitalized in xterm. So capital X, capital T, lowercase erm. Now, I don't know where it gets that, because if I do app res xterm with no capitals, it just kind of, it does nothing. All right, so maybe what it really wants is the full path, /bin/xterm. Nope, doesn't do anything. App res with a XT capitalized erm gives me a whole bunch of stuff. And what it gives me are, apparently, the resources. And what that means exactly isn't super clear, but it says that the form thickness is 0. The VT100.UTF font4 uses MISC fixed medium R normal -13/120/75/75C80/ISO/10646-1. And so on. So every line has a new, I guess, resource. Now, I don't know what these resources are exactly. I mean, they're resources, like X, I think, X11, like, resources. But, I mean, what does that mean? What is a resource? It says the menu bar dot border width is 0. So, to me, these look like properties. That's what I would define these as. But, okay, I'll accept that this is a resource of an X application. There it is, a big listing of it. And that seems, I don't know, vaguely useful. The thing that I don't quite understand is how you know what the heck the name of the application is. So if I do appres xpdf, for instance, I get nothing back. If I do appres, I guess let's just try x, capital x, maybe pdf? No, how about capital xpdf? No, how about capital x pdf, all capitals? No. So I don't know, I don't understand how I'm supposed to know what the application sort of like considers itself. That just seems mysterious to me. So let's try URXVT. I had it right the first time. No, that is also not valid. And randomly capitalizing things doesn't seem... Oh, I just got it. URXVT. So again, the first two letters capital. And I don't think that's... I don't think that's a standard. I don't think it's just like... whatever you pass it, capitalize the first two letters. Because I did try XPDF, and I got nothing. So it's not just the first two letters. It just happens to be the first two letters for these two applications. But anyway, I get a list of what I would consider properties. And because I actually use URXVT, these properties look pretty darn familiar to me. These are straight out of .xdefaults. That's my configuration file for my URXVT. So if I go over to .xdefaults, indeed, that is, these are my settings for URXVT. So there's a setting for the font and for the background color, the highlight colors, a couple of extensions to like give myself some tabs within URXVT, what browser to use for my URL launcher. So they are familiar, and I guess those are considered resources in the language of what I'll call old school X. I mean, I guess these are, you know, like current things. I just didn't know they were called resources. So that's something that I've learned. And if you want to see what your application would require as its resources, or not require, but what resources it is calling, then you can use app res. How to know what your application is called, however, I cannot say. I do not know the answer to this. I thought it might have something to do with the entries. Eventually, I thought maybe the entries in user share applications, like maybe that's where you find that information out. And for a while, I thought I was correct, because, for instance, rxvt-unicode.desktop lists has a listing startup wm class equals UR, capital UR, XVT. So I thought, well, that's exactly what I'm looking for. X-term, same, not exactly the same thing, but certainly its name, the like name equals XT, X-term with a capital XT. So that seems to, so maybe it's something about usership. But then if you look in XPDF, the name is X space PDF, all capitals. Okay, well, I can try that. There's nothing else sort of referencing a name or a class. So if it's going to be anything, I guess it's going to be that one. So let's do app res quote X space PDF, close quote, all capitals, nothing. What if we put like a dash there? No, nothing. What if we just escape, don't use the quotes, escape the space? Nothing. So I don't know. Maybe XPDF just doesn't use any resources or something, and that's why it's not coming up. I'm not sure. I don't know. Let's try XFig really quick. That's a program, right? No, it's not. How about XEdit? That, I know that exists. XEdit, appres, XEdit, nothing. XEdit with a capital X and E, nothing. Oh, XEdit with just a capital X. I don't know. This is anybody's guess, and I don't think I could, I unless there's something that I am missing, and apparently there is, I just don't know what on earth this could be. However, like, I don't know how you would know the name of your application without just trying, you know, every possible variation. But this does seem useful. Like, I mean, it does list all of the properties, at least I should say all the properties defined for that, for this application. So it's kind of like, well, it's an application essentially to look at the configuration of your of an application on your machine without having to launch the application. And that seems really useful. Like, I mean, not an everyday, oh, I use it all the time kind of useful, but I mean, it seems like a useful, handy thing to have. And I kind of wish that existed for a lot more than just X, little random little X applications. I would love to just have a call to an application and get a quick summary of all of the configuration options that have been set. Now, having said that, really, you do a find for an application, some portion of an application's name in your home directory or in your .config directory or your .local directory, and you're probably going to find what you're looking for. So I don't know how realistically, how like absolutely useful app res really is, but back when I guess applications maybe were structured a little bit differently and your configuration file wasn't certainly located in a predictable place and might not even have the name of your application in it, like X defaults or dot X defaults, that doesn't say to me, oh, that's the configuration for URXVT or even for RXVT or anything. It sounds more like something, some big sort of global system-wide configuration. So I think there's a little bit of a strangeness with that. And maybe that's what X defaults originally was. Like, you put sort of a registry of configuration options for lots of different applications, the names of which I don't know how you would know what to put. Like, the only reason I knew what to put for my URXVT configuration in X defaults was because, you know, somebody told me, or a magazine article told me, or however I found all of my options that I use today. I just copied and pasted it and then caught on to the fact that, oh, this is actually called URXVT. Okay, well, that's what I'll call it. So I'm not sure if I love this method of configuration all around, but I think if I was going to do it, I would love to have AppRes. Next one in the list is BDF to PCF. This is, in its own words, fonts in portable compiled format can be read, that's PCF, can be read by any architecture, but the file is structured to allow one particular architecture to read them directly without reformatting. This, the PDF to PCF, I guess, allows fast reading on the appropriate machine, and the files are still portable, but read more slowly on other machines. So the BDF in the name of this application stands for Bitmap Distribution Format. This is a format developed by, you guessed it, Adobe. It is a file format for storing bitmap fonts. Now, if you know anything about modern fonts, you'll know that that's not how fonts are done anymore. They're just they're done with their vector art stored in, used to be a TTF file, now more often than not, I think it's like an OTF file or maybe some other variation of that. But back when like BDF to PCF was something that you might need, the fonts were bitmap files. And what this application does is it converts your bitmap distribution format font, your BDF font, to something called PCF, which I've just described, or rather Pat Volkerding has just described in the summary of what this package contains, this font compiler for the X server and font server. So you take your BDF fonts, you transform them into PCF, which allows your, you know, whatever your architecture, your OS, your setup is, can now read those font files without reformatting them or changing anything. And the cool thing is, I guess, that the PCF format is portable. So you could take that to, I mean, that's what it stands for, portable compiled format. You could take it to another Linux box on your network or you know, in your building or whatever, and use those fonts, those compiled fonts on that machine. It might take longer to load or draw or something, I guess. I don't know. But it is still usable. So it seems like a really great thing to have if you're still using BDF and PCF fonts, which typically, you know, a lot of us aren't going to be. That you might be, because it is, you know, fonts, bitmapped fonts on like your, just your, you don't have a modern application that uses, you know, vector fonts, or you don't even have an X server installed at all. Well, actually that wouldn't apply here, because that's BDF to PCF font compiler for the X server and font server. So I guess that might not apply. So I guess, yeah, if you're using an application that just doesn't use vector fonts, then you might be using a PCF font or a BDF font and not even realizing it. If you ever need to convert that over to PCF, though, now you know where to go. Next package in the list is Before Light. I am going to uninstall this application after I talk about it because it is an absolute waste of time, but it's Before Light. That's what it is. It's a screensaver, but it doesn't support like screen locking or any kind of configuration. And if you type it in to your terminal and hit return, literally nothing happens. It just sits there. So I don't know what kind of screensaver it thinks it is, but it doesn't actually save your screen. I mean, it doesn't, you know, like screensavers are supposed to at least black out your screen so that the theory is that, you know, the lights of your screen won't sort of burn themselves into the screen of your screen. I don't even know if that's really even a thing anymore, but a lot of us still use screensavers, if nothing else, just to lock the screen, right? When you're walking away from your laptop, maybe put a screensaver on so that someone can't come up and even just accidentally mess something up on your computer. But Before Light doesn't do that. There's apparently no configuration options for it. And really, it's apparently included here at all for just like as a sample application. Which, again, I don't really know that that's useful in an application that doesn't work. So I'm not even sure the value of this package at all. Yeah, and this is an ELF 64-bit LSB executable. So, like, the source code isn't even here. You'd have to go get the source code. Sudo slack pkg remove Before Light. Yes, I do want to do that. Okay, perfect. Next in the list is Bitmap, an application, or a package rather, with applications that apparently I know how to use, although I have no idea what they're for. It may just be as simple as it seems, but I keep thinking there must be some deeper reason for it. But the Bitmap package contains applications called Bitmap, BM2A, and A2BM. So that's ASCII to bitmap, or bitmap to ASCII, and then this thing called bitmap. So if you launch bitmap, you get a GUI, little GUI application written, you know, with the X, the old sort of X look and feel. And it's got this grid on it. I don't know if, let's call it a 20 by 20 grid. Might be 16 by 16, probably. 16 by 16 grid, let's say. And you can click around in it and make little bitmaps, like shapes. Like, it's a drawing application, in other words. There's a couple of different tools. And interestingly, I actually only know how to use one, which is the point tool. That's the only one that seems to work. If I select curve, I get nothing drawn. If I select line or rectangle or filled rectangle or circle, nothing draws. So I don't know what I'm missing there, but the point tool does work. And frankly, while you're kind of doing bitmap art, that's kind of all you need, right? I mean, you just want to do like little dots. That's the point. If you right click on something that you've filled in, then that's erasing. If you left click, you're filling that pixel in. So eventually you get something that you're happy with and you think that you want to, I guess, translate it into ASCII for some reason. So what I'm going to do is I'll go to the file menu and I'll press and hold, because if you just click, it doesn't stay open. So click and hold, and I'll do a save as, and we'll call it happy, because I drew a happy face. And I'll say okay to that. And now in my temporary directory here, I have a file called happy. And if I do file happy, it's an XBM image, 16 by 16. That's ASCII text. Okay. So if I do a cat on happy, it's actually, it's C code. Hash define happy underscore width 16, hash define happy underscore height 16, static unsigned car, happy underscore bits, square bracket equals curly brace 0x00 comma 0x00, and so on until you start to get to the pixels that are actually filled in. So that's what gets saved out of this simple bitmap pixel art application. And interestingly, what you can do with this is, I mean, you could open it back up in the pixel art application, but you can also do BM2A on happy, and you get an ASCII representation of the pixel art that you've just drawn in bitmap. And as you might expect, if I copy that ASCII representation of it and quickly paste it into a file I'll call fun, that should work. Okay, yeah. Okay, and save that. Now if I go from, so if I do A to BM, fun, I get the C output I get the C output that I saw originally in the happy file. So it is exactly what it says. I mean, it's got the bitmap application for your GUI pixel art, and then a command BM2A to convert that to ASCII, and a file in case you did it the other way around to go from ASCII to bitmap. Meaning that if you wanted to, you could just open up a text editor and use dashes and hash marks to create sort of a kind of what will be pixel art, and then use A to BM, and you'll get an XBM file that you could open in bitmap to see your bitmap pixel art. Weird. I don't know what it's for. I mean, it could be as simple as that. I don't know if there's some other like reason for that existing. Like, is that how they made icons a long time ago? I don't know. I'm not really sure. But it seems like a fun little tool. What also seems really fun is cup of coffee. So let's go get some. We'll come back, finish up the show. I'm assuming you have coffee. I certainly do. Next package in the list is the CLDR emoji annotation files. Now, these come from, as delivered in Slack, where they come from github.com/fujiwarat/CLDR-emoji-annotation. But if you go to that page, the author, the maintainer of that repository has declared this unmaintained and points to the source instead, which is github.com/unicode-org/CLDR. And if you look around in the CLDR repo, you go into the common directory, go into annotations, you find a bunch of different annotation files. What's an annotation file? Well, it's a file that it's XML. I think the schema is specifically LDML, if I recall correctly, which stands for Local Data Markup Language. And it's pretty familiar. I mean, if you've ever seen XML, this is XML. It's just the schema that has the special name. But it's thousands of lines of annotation and then an emoji, like a little happy face or something, and then a description of what that emoji is. So for instance, here is, I'm just scrolling down, line 1744. It is a little emoji of a poodle. The one under that is annotated. It's a little, I see that it's a little animal head or something. And the annotation is animal, pipe, face, pipe, wolf. And let's see, if I scroll down more, you get like things like animal, dragon, fairy, fairy tale, knights, and tail. So you kind of get the sense of what this is from that context, I think. I mean, these are emoji that you're likely to find in some kind of emoji selector. And these annotations, it's basically the metadata about the emoji. So if you were to type in tale, T-A-L-E, then one of the things that would come up, because it's in the annotation, tale, is this little dragon emoji. And if you were to type in dragon, then that emoji would also come up. So there's a little bit of, you know, depending on how these are annotated or described, there's a little bit of different fuzziness to the search. And they're fascinating to look through. I mean, animal, dressage, equine, face, farm, horses. Obviously, some specialized knowledge goes into these annotations, and it's very cool. From what I understand, there's kind of an open call for contribution at specific times throughout, I don't know, the year or several years. I don't know when it opens. I didn't bother clicking on that link, but it does look like, I mean, it's an open source thing. You can contribute to it. And these annotations do strike me in many cases as something, as things that people who really have a connection to an emoji actually contribute to. It's pretty interesting. Also interesting is it took me a while to fully grasp what these annotation files were, because some of the annotation files, I mean, I looked at EN_GB just because it was kind of there. I'm not British, but I do live in New Zealand, so there's a certain amount of British English here, but that's not why I clicked on it. I just clicked on it because that was the one that I saw that I thought, okay, I will understand that one, so I just clicked on it. And in that file, a lot of the annotations were kind of missing, and they just had upward pointing arrows as the annotation, which was really, really odd. Couldn't figure out, I wasn't really sure what I was looking at. I didn't even connect the fact that the annotation itself referred to the emoji. I was pretty confused. I think I looked at some other files as well and saw the same kinds of occurrences. But as it turns out, I from what I'm gathering, context clues, three upward pointing arrows means defer to one of the other, like the parent file of a variant. So if en.xml is English, then en_au or en_gb or en_ca. And rather than putting duplicate annotations in those files, as far as I can tell, they use upward pointing arrows to say or to indicate to something, I don't know what, to a person, to a machine, to both, that the entry from the parent language should be used in place of that. Now, in for instance, the British annotation file, there were some entries, and I'm assuming those are the ones specific to sort of that dialect or that regional, you know, a regional difference. So for instance, I think it's a quarter note, maybe it's a 60, I don't know, some kind of note, I don't remember which one, apparently in England is called a quaver. So no one else would know that. So in the British annotation file, it has the word quaver for that note, whereas in the parent file, it has the other name, the the other name, the 16th note or quarter note or whatever it is. Like I say, I don't remember which one it is. So that's the annotation files. I guess look at the top level annotation for your language first, and then go into the variants for additional regionalisms. Next package is CompIz. And CompIz, I mean, when I was getting into Linux back in 2006, 7, 8, that time frame, CompIz was a big deal. I don't know if it was like new on the scene at the time, or if it was just kind of reaching a peak at the time, but CompIz is a visually, dare I say, ostentatious window manager. So a window, this is interesting too, because I mean, with Linux, there are so many, I mean, just look, I've filled up how many years of this show going through every single package on a Slackware distribution. That sort of is indicative of how many components there are exposed on a Linux system. And while that can seem overwhelming at times, it's also, it's the reality. These systems exist on other systems, on other operating systems. Like, all these components exist. It's just that they're not shown to you, and sometimes they're not even separated out from one another. I mean, I'm sure they are, probably, maybe in the code base, but you don't get access to that sort of thing. So on Linux, you get to see all of these components for what they are. And you kind of, if you sit down and really ponder it, you start to see the separation of these things. So on your when you're looking at a desktop on Linux, you're looking at, we say desktop, of course, really what we first mean is that you're looking at your screen. Now on that screen, if you don't have any application that you are conscious of running, then you probably really are looking at let's call it a wallpaper, which we consider your desktop. That's the analogy that we use. That's your desktop. But of course, a desktop, when we actually say desktop in the modern day and age, we also mean things like, well, there surely must be a clock. Everyone's got a clock on their desktop. And there must be an application menu where you can go and launch applications so that you can run more than just a desktop on your computer. There must be a network manager so you can join a Wi-Fi network, or so you can plug in an Ethernet cable and join that network and switch between them, maybe join a VPN, whatever. There must be volume control and all these other little widgets that we all take for granted at this point, because that's just part of the computer desktop. And yet you can't take those for granted. Those are panels. Those are panels floating above your desktop, sort of. If we define the desktop as basically the big blank area where you put things. So you can have desktop panels, and you can also, of course, obviously, have windows. These application windows appear within your desktop, and you can shuffle them around. And again, the analogy is that, like, you're shuffling papers around on your desktop, or folders on your desktop. And that's fine. That's functional analogy. It works. It is a bit weird because, I mean, paper doesn't really do all the cool things that applications do, but, you know, like, this is all high tech, so let's just go with it. There's the desktop, and there's these windows. Now, if you want to be able to move those windows around, we decided, like, someone decided in their design, probably Xerox or something, we decided that you have to have a handle on the paper. Like, you can't pick up the sheet of paper that's lying on your desktop. You couldn't do that in real life. You can't do it on a computer. No, I'm kidding. Of course, you can do that in real life. But on a computer, for some reason, you can't do that. On Linux, you can. You can hold down the Alt key on your keyboard and then click anywhere in a window, generally speaking. I mean, there's probably an application out there that's the exception, but generally speaking, hold down the Alt key on your keyboard and click anywhere in a window and then drag it around, and it lets you drag the window down as if though you'd grabbed it by the window title bar. But on most operating systems, and I think most people's muscle memory, You don't click on in your application window. You click on the decoration around the window. And most of us don't really think about where that decoration comes from, because, I mean, to us, that's just part of the window, right? I mean, a window has a title bar? Well, not really. The window is just the application. It is the view into the application. That is the widget that is created is the window itself. There, you don't get all the stuff around it. That's not part of the operating. That's not part of the window, the application. That is part of something else. As I say, on most operating systems, that's just kind of like part of the operating system, you know, it's just kind of part of it. But on Linux, it is distinctly a product of, well, a window decorator, and those windows, once you grab onto the window decoration, you can move them around and stack them on top of each other and do whatever. That's the window manager at work. That's what the window manager allows you to do, is move those windows around, stack them in front of each other, maybe minimize them, that sort of thing. Certainly the window manager would do the minimization. Yeah, would have to. So that's the window manager, and that's one of the things that CompIz can provide, is the window decoration around windows. And obviously, because there is window decoration, you can also grab those windows and move them around. But one of the things that CompIz does that a lot of other window managers don't bother doing is it has gone out of its way historically to be visually appealing or visually exciting. And I'm talking about like windows that when you click the X to close a window, rather than just fading out, you know, when windows go away, they usually have a slight fade to them. So, but rather than just fading out, with CompIz, you could have them burst into flames, or when you minimize a window, you could have the window sort of collapse in on itself and minimize to the bottom of the screen. And by collapse in on itself, I mean sort of turn into jelly and sort of drip down into the bottom of the screen. Or I guess it's more like a genie effect. I'm not really sure what kind of effect it's supposed to be, but there are different visual things that can happen thanks to CompIz because CompIz has these options built in. Now, the package on Slackware is just literally CompIz. There is no configuration helper. There's no way to change how CompIz behaves. I don't even know that there's a way to sort of force CompIz to be your window manager out of the box. Luckily, on Slack builds, there are other components within the CompIz ecosystem that you can install to make it kind of to bring it all together. So I used a virtual machine for this just because I'm quite happy with the way that my desktop is working right now, and I didn't want to change it in real life. But on the virtual machine, I launched XFCE because that's what I've been running on my virtual machine, because we are getting dangerously close to the XFCE directory in the software series, and I want to make sure that I've actually used XFCE enough to talk about it when that time arrives. But so luckily XFCE, KDE is okay at separating all of these elements, but I do feel like KDE is a little bit, like the Plasma Desktop has a little bit condensed things into one another. It's a little bit harder to sort of swap out KWin with something else. I mean, it's not, but it's, I don't know. I feel like it kind of downplays some of the separation, whereas XFCE, actually, I don't know if that XFCE really makes that big of a deal either, but for XFCE, it's XFWM, I'm pretty sure, for the XF window manager. That's what normally handles all the windows on an XFCE desktop, but you can replace that with CompIz, certainly by just doing CompIz --replace, like that would work. But the other way to do it, and I guess the more permanent way to do that, or actually, sorry, it should be CompIz --replace and then the ampersand so that you could get your prompt back. The other way to do it is to install CompIz-bcop, CompIz-plugins-main, CompIz-config-python, and libcompizconfig. So that is four additional packages from slackbuilds.org, and these provide you with a bunch of options so that you can configure what your CompIz window manager does. After you install these, you get the in your settings window, menu, submenu, in XFCE, go to applications and settings, and then compiz config settings manager. And this is to me, this is just an old classic. This is such a familiar configuration control panel because, again, when I was getting into Linux, like, this was the biggest of deals. Like, this, if you could get your desktop running compiz, like, then you knew what you were doing. And I don't remember why there was that reputation of compiz. I mean, certainly compiz had a lot of just ridiculous effects, wobbly windows, windows that would jiggle when you move them around, a cool minimizing effects, more animations, blur windows, like when you had one window as your active window, the others would blur behind it. Water effects. I don't even remember what that is. It adds water effects to different desktop actions, apparently. Fading windows, which I don't think that seems very exciting nowadays, but probably at the time it did. Certainly window decoration, which is on by default here. So you have lots of different options within compiz, and that was a big deal. I feel like potentially there was a thing about whether you're that wobbly window effect is still just the coolest. I just love it. Oh man, I love it. I love the wobbly windows. Yeah, I honestly, if KDE Plasma Desktop had a wobbly window, maybe it does. Maybe it's got a wobbly window effect. I need to find out now. System settings, it'd be under desktop effects probably, right? Is that still a thing? Is that desktop? Does that not exist anymore? No, here it is, desktop effects. Let's look for, wobble. Yeah, wobbly windows is available on KDE. Okay, now I've got it. Oh, that's beautiful. It's just so beautiful. It just feels so organic that way. Anyway, compiz has wobbly windows, and so now I'm running my virtual machine with wobbly windows inside of a KDE window that also wobbles. So multiple levels of wobble. Anyway, so compiz, there might have been a thing about the CPU, the GPUs. Like, could your graphics card handle compiz? So that might have been part of it. But there was a certain mystique to compiz, I feel like, a long time ago. And now, as I've just kind of demonstrated by becoming distracted myself, a lot of these compiz effects, like wobbly windows, they're just kind of things that you can have for free in something like Plasma Desktop. So maybe the mystique is a little bit, I don't want to say it's less, as if though something has been taken away from compiz. It's just that compiz, if we look at it as compiz, would you like to completely change the way Linux desktops configure, what options a Linux desktop provides its users? Well, then compiz has done that. Like, if that was the goal, compiz has absolutely done. Even if KDE Plasma Desktop is using a wobbly window that has no relationship to compiz code base, the concept is directly from compiz, and that's just kind of pretty cool. But compiz has a bunch of other stuff as well that, again, like, I think we take it for granted now, but it can do things like, in the window management department, it can do things like scaling windows. So it can allow you to view all of, all the open windows on your system, running on your desktop in one place, by quickly scaling all of them down and putting them onto one screen for you. And that, again, I've got that on Plasma Desktop, and I have had that for ages. I don't know if I could live without that one. That's just such a great little feature. Snapping windows, what a great feature. Various window rules. You can just create your own rules that you want to apply to windows, such as this one always appears above, these other ones, or this one always opens maximized, and so on. So there's a bunch of things that compiz allows you to do that, yeah, I think these days we take it for granted because a lot of people have adopted these ideas and just made them part of the Linux desktop. But that doesn't mean that compiz is useless. I mean, it's very useful. It still exists. You can still run CompiZ on, for instance, your XFCE desktop, which is what I have been doing on my virtual machine, because it has a lot of cool features that I don't think XFCE does have by default. I could be wrong. I didn't look to recreate CompiZ before switching to CompiZ, but I don't know that XFWM has the window management feature of, for instance, you know, the scaling the windows, or a really very easy way to zoom in and out of your screen. I don't need that right now, but I mean, I do, again, use that on Plasma Desktop, actually. It's great for presentations when you're trying to zoom into something that you need some, you know, your audience to kind of focus on. And then, of course, one of the really, really cool features of CompiZ, and I feel like this is one of the ones that you kind of saw all over the place, was the desktop cube. And this is when it placed your desktops, your virtual desktops on Linux, on the sides of a cube. And then when you switched from one desktop to another, you witnessed your very desktop sort of receding from your screen, sort of back into the space of your screen, as it were, and then flip over as if a big cube was being rotated inside your screen, and then present itself at a full screen again. It was just such a cool effect, and it just made, I mean, it added that extra dimensionality to the Linux desktop. And I think in a way there was kind of a meta statement being made by that, or maybe that's what people were connecting to. I don't know if it was intentional, but certainly for me at the time, I just felt like I was learning so much about computers through Linux that computing itself had become more of a, if you will, a three-dimensional object. You know, new dimensions of computing had been opened up to me through Linux. And so then having this visual representation of, like, as if though, hey, your desktop is this flat screen and you're staring at it all day. But look, if you switch to this other secret desktop over to the right or to the left, then we're gonna zoom out. We're gonna show you the object, and then we'll flip over to a new desktop, and then you'll be back in. It's like you were stepping outside of the computing process. I mean, I knew at the time that you weren't. I mean, I understood that it was all visual effects, but that's the way it felt to me. It was as if though switching a desktop on Linux was kind of representing the idea that yes, there are aspects of computing that you just didn't know about before, and if you zoom out a little bit and take a step back and look at everything, then you can gain a better understanding of it. And that's what the CompiZ Desktop Cube kind of represented to me. So that's CompiZ. I mean, really, like I say, for it to be useful, you do want to install those extra applications. That's the main thing. CompiZ, you've got it, 0.8.18, you've got it on Slackware, but for it to be something that you use and configure the way that you want it to look, you're going to want CompiZ-bcop, CompiZ-plugins-main, CompiZ-config-python, and libcompiz-config. And I'll put those in the show notes so that you have that for easy reference. And then just give it a try. Just launch it. Launch it on XFCE or on KDE and see what happens. See if you like it. Let's talk about Deja Vu. Not the phenomenon, but the font. Deja Vu fonts are a sort of an expansion pack of something called Bitstream Vera, and this was a little bit before my time with, you know, with Linux, really. So I'm kind of going off of information cobbled off of like Wikipedia and from Deja Vu itself and from archive.org on some old gnome.org pages. But apparently Bitstream Vera was a font that was created by Jim Lyles at a company called Bitstream, which I guess no longer exists. But this was a font that Jim Lyles created and released with a very permissive license. In fact, the license is very close to what would eventually become the Open Font License. I don't believe that the Open Font License claims to have been based on this. I'm just saying the two licenses are pretty similar, or like they have similar features is what I'm trying to express, which is a good thing. That's great. So this, I think Bitstream became kind of an official font of GNOME for a while. I didn't get into GNOME really until GNOME 3. I did not care for GNOME 2, and certainly GNOME 1 was way before my time. So my time with Linux. So I don't know about that, but it's a font. It's a sensible kind of computer font. I don't know how many variants there were in Bitstream. Certainly Deja Vu has a sans variant, a serif variant, and a mono variant, which is kind of what you need. And it is essentially Bitstream Vera, a free license, so you know you can use it wherever. And it is a nice, sensible font. I don't know what else to say about it. I don't know what kind of, I'm not into fonts enough to know sort of like what to compare it to, or what to say that it's like, or what kind of attributes it has. It's just, it's if you've installed Linux in the past, then you've probably seen either Bitstream or Deja Vu. Possibly not, but it does tend to get bundled with your with distributions because they're open fonts and they're easy to include. And, you know, there's a lot of work has gone into them. I think fonts in general are a fascinating study when you start looking into licensing and software models and things like that, because really everyone treats them so casually until you don't. You know, it's like, oh, don't worry about the fonts, like just whatever font, just get a font from here, get a font from there, it just doesn't matter. And then all of a sudden, like at some point, you're trying to sell something and you realize, oh my gosh, I'm using a font that I'm not allowed to use in this context. And what that context is isn't really declared that well. Like if you really look, you know, you really do have to look for the terms of agreement for a font. Like you really have to hunt it down. It is not easy to find. And I'm not talking about with open source fonts. I'm talking about with, like, you know, the professional fonts that come out of font foundries, as they call themselves. Like, you don't really, you're not really sort of told what the terms are. You just get a bunch of fonts and you think, well, these are ways of typing on my computer. I guess I can just do whatever I want to with them. And generally you can, but then in some cases you can't. And then, of course, there's the whole thing about Google fonts and how including a Google font on your website it makes this call over to the Google servers, and sometimes that slows your performance down, and other times it just causes all these other, you know, these extraneous messages off site and so on. So I mean, I think fonts are just, they're such a casual and kind of serene kind of thing that we just take for granted, and yet there's really quite a lot there. And I mean, honestly, I don't use non-open source fonts really. I mean, I might, they might be somewhere that I'm using a non-free font, you know, without sort of realizing it or whatever. But generally speaking, if I'm choosing a font to install on my system, and if I'm choosing a font from my system, to the best of my knowledge, that it's open source. And that's the easiest thing to do. And really some of the open source fonts out there are the most recognizable and the most fun and the most sort of flavorful. And it just doesn't make sense for me to use anything but an open source font. But, you know, places out there, they do it, they use them. And for a lot of people, it just doesn't ever matter, which is fair. It shouldn't matter, really. The fact that it could technically matter is kind of silly. And I think that's what I mean. It's like, it kind of like, it just shouldn't really matter. But for whatever reason, we're pretending like this is a big deal. And by we, I mean, you know, like Adobe, pretty much. They're the ones pretending like it's a big deal. Nobody else actually cares, but Adobe is going to try to, you know, when it needs to, it's going to reinforce some kind of forgotten copyright on a font and mess everyone's day up. I don't obviously care to be bothered by that. So open source fonts are the way to go for me. Deja Vu, I don't think there's anything particularly special about the font. I mean, it really is. It is a very functional font. It is a font that just kind of you could see yourself using it by default because it is the font. It's a readable font. It's just very sort of what you see is what you get. Like those glyphs are recognizable glyphs. But I mean, really, so many times that's really all you need, to be honest. So I don't know. They're nice. I appreciate them as sort of the obvious default set of fonts. That said, of course, there are lots of other obvious default fonts that you could use as well. So it's not just Deja Vu, but that's the one we're talking about right now. It's a common one. You've probably seen it on a Linux distribution, either in a selection box of fonts that you could use, or maybe as the default font that you just don't even think about half the time. And the last package of the episode is EditRes. EditRes is an interesting old school X11 application about editing existing X11 applications. So the only X11 application I could think of off the top of my head was Bitmap, which I talked about in the previous episode, I think. And it was that the Bitmap editor where you open it up and it is clearly, what's the widget set, XT or something like that. It is old school X11, not even GTK. Like it's a very, very old kind of widget set. So the way that these applications are structured is that they have these resources that they're using. And with EditRes, or EditRes, I guess is really how you'd have to say it, because it stands for Edit Resource. When you launch Edit Resource, you get a window. It's mostly empty. There's a message field at the top, and then there's just two menu buttons. There's commands and tree. The first step you want to do is get a tree. And what tree you're getting is a list of all the resources and how they connect to one another of another application. So I've launched Bitmap in one window and EditRes in another window. And then I go to EditRes tree, and you have to hold down the mouse button because the menu doesn't stay open. So you click and hold and then go down to get tree. And then you click on the bitmap window, and that populates a little flowchart or chart of some sort, sort of like a family tree type thing. There's probably an official name for that kind of chart. I don't know it though. It's a chart of all the different resources contained in the window that you've just clicked on. This is the resource tree of that window. So the very, very top level of it, or the leftmost level, as this is orientated from left to right, is bitmap. And from there, you've got a parent box, and also an image box, and an input, and an error, and a queue save, and a shell ext. And within the parent, you've got, what do you have? You've got a couple of different things, grip, shell ext, and for me. And within for me, you have things like file button, edit button, status. Now this is starting to look a little bit familiar, because file button and edit button, those do exist in the bitmap window. Like those are literal widgets I can see with my own eyes, the menu bar, file, and edit. I don't know what status is. That must be the status bar. I don't know where that is. Probably down at the bottom, maybe. I don't know where the status bar is on this application. But those are very recognizable things. There's a bitmap and a grip. I don't know what grip is. For me, I'm assuming is the kind of class that defines, like, maybe buttons, or no, certainly that would be file button. So maybe that the for me maybe is like the horizontal the H box container that the buttons are in, maybe, or you know, the menu bar itself. I'm not sure. Yeah, probably a menu box basically, or a menu bar. So I'm gonna click on the file button the file button resource in EditRes. To get more information about the file button, you can go to the commands menu and go to show resource box. And this shows you this drills down into that resource. So the path of this resource is .bitmap.parent.forme.filebutton.unknown, apparently. And normal resources, MB2 gets a value. I feel like MB is probably mouse button 2. So I don't know. Here's something that looks vaguely recognizable. It's called background. Okay. Down at the bottom of this resource box, there's an inter resource value. So I'm going to do hash. Let's do E4. No, E4, red E4. Let's do 3-3 for G, and then let's do, I don't know, 1-1 for blue, and then I'm gonna hit apply, and I'm watching the bitmap window, and I have just turned the file button in bitmap orange, and I could do the same thing with edit, or I could do, maybe I could change the font, for instance, the font of the of file. I could change the font resource value, or the foreground color, so the color of the letters. Label, I don't really know what that's referring to, the justification and so on. So there are a bunch of, even the position, there's an X and Y value, so presumably that would change the actual position of that resource. So you can go into a running application and rearrange it, insert new values into the resource tree, and cause it to change the way it looks. How you would then get that to sort of like stay a permanent part of that application, I don't understand. I don't know how that works. I don't see any information really on that. Certainly if I close bitmap and then relaunch it, that's, you know, I don't get my edited resources. That was a editing something on, you know, in real time, and there's no, there doesn't seem to be sort of like a, I guess there's a dump widget tree to a file, but that, I don't really know how that would change anything. So I don't know if this is like a sort of just an analytical tool, or whether it's intended to be used to make lasting changes. There is a note in the man page by the author that says there are, where is this note? It says, this is a prototype. There are lots of nifty features I would love to add, but I hope this gives you some idea of what a resource editor can do. So it feels to me like this is a proof of concept written, you know, probably, who knows, when, like ages ago, right? Oh, Athena widget set. That's what that's called, apparently. Probably ages ago. It's by Chris Peterson, formerly MIT X Consortium. So I get a feeling that this isn't meant to be the thing, you know, a real application to modify the way your applications look, to theme your applications. I think it was probably more about like, hey, this is how X11 stores resource information. This is how you could access it in theory. And isn't that cool? And mightn't you do something neat with that later on? I think at the time, probably that was very, probably educational and maybe even progressive. I mean, it seems like a pretty cool thing to be able to do. I would love for it to be able to retain those changes. But in the modern day, I mean, for my money, really CSS is the pinnacle for me of scalable interface design. I just think CSS is amazing. I think it does some of the best layout work possible. And I know there are probably lots of good reasons for not using CSS in everything, but honestly, I just wonder why we don't use CSS in everything. There's not an application that just, I in my opinion, that wouldn't benefit from the fluidity of CSS. And again, I'm sure there are lots of actually very good reasons that I am not thinking about, because I haven't designed that many applications that I would know all the edge cases or all the pragmatic reasons for it. But I do love CSS, and that, you know, in my mind, in theory, I would just love to be able to have just custom CSS for any given application on your computer. I think that would be such a cool feature. People could share CSS files for certain looks and feels, for certain accessibility issues, and so on. And it would just, I think it would just solve lots of problems. I could be wrong. I'm not, this isn't a thing that I've thought about and pondered at length. It's just something that I often, you know, when I want to change one little thing to an application, I just think, you know, if only I had like a CSS ID for that thing, or a class name for that thing, then I could just make one little quick change and put it in some kind of configuration place, and suddenly it would be different forever, and it would be so easy. But of course, it's not how things work. So if it were how things would work, that would be very cool. And there is some CSS customization built in with Qt and probably other things. I think, I mean, GTK, like the newest one, doesn't it like run in a web browser if you want it to? So, or, you know, it can at least display in a web browser. So there are cool places where things are merging, technologies are merging, and And I kind of like to think that that's the slow and steady progress towards true customizable interfaces. And this is, you know, I mean, I don't know where we are on that journey, or if we're even on that journey as a people. But if we are, then you could say EditRes was an early step towards that. And even if I'm just dreaming and making things up, then certainly EditRes, at least the author states, I mean, this is the power of just sort of having all of these attributes, having access to all of these attributes. Like in theory, and I don't know if that was the author's intent, but in theory, you could make an application possibly, you know, better for a user by editing the resources. And I mean, it would be a lot of work, but you could, you know, invert the entire application for people who can't see dark on light and prefer to see light on dark instead, or whatever. And I don't know if that ever became a thing for X11. I don't know how. I feel like night mode was just 5 years ago. We all got night mode for practically, well, for sort of everything. Although, I mean, we didn't. Like, we still don't have dark mode for everything. It's just for a lot of stuff we have it. There are just little weird touches like that I feel like as a computing people we should have that already. I don't know if X11 ever got there. I don't remember ever seeing a switch to toggle dark mode for X11, but certainly Edit Resource demonstrates how you can change in an application's look through setting attributes. And if that was a big deal then, that's cool. If it was just for educational purposes because people just didn't know about X resources, I don't know. But it's a cool little application to play around with. I think that's everything for this episode. Thanks for listening. I'll talk to you next time.